Good morning. Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Christina Spouty, and I am serving as worship associate this morning. I'm joined in welcoming you today by the Reverend Harold Walker, a friend of this congregation and our guest today. When I volunteered to serve as worship associate for this service, all I knew was that Reverend Walker would be leading it. There was no topic listed, and when he and I discussed the plans for this service this last week, I was unfamiliar with Zacchaeus' story. I was thinking about the service late the other night when it struck me how much it seemed to resonate with an incident in my own life. The circumstances are different, but for me, the transformative experience was essentially the same. I was raised by parents who loved me, but my growing up years were difficult, and I would say often dark and stormy. As I matured, my life didn't improve the way I had thought it would. On January 1st, 2003, 12 days after I turned 25, I woke up with the instant realization that my inner life and my outer life were in great discord, meaning that my outer life, my interactions with the world, didn't seem to be an expression of who I knew I was in my heart and mind. And I knew that I needed to change, or my life would never be what I knew that it should be. I have worked since then to be the woman I knew I was inside in my daily life. I would say that on that morning, the universe recognized my deep heartache and pain and answered my tearful question of what to do by granting me the insight I needed to change my life if I was willing to do what needed to be done. And so the story is similar for Zacchaeus, the individual who will be considered in the story to be reflected on in the sermon, whose life was also touched by divine grace and so saved. I smile at the unexpected connection I've gotten to feel. I don't know what direction the sermon will take, what conclusion, if any, that Reverend Walker will reach, but I hope that you will share my openness and curiosity to seek for some resonance in your own lives. Our wisdom words this morning have been attributed to Mother Teresa. People are often unreasonable and self-centered. Forgive them anyway. If you are kind, people may accuse you of ulterior motives. Be kind anyway. If you are honest, people may cheat you. Be honest anyway. If you find happiness, people may be jealous. Be happy anyway. The good you do today may be forgotten tomorrow. Do good anyway. Give the world the best you have, and it may never be enough. Do good anyway. For you see, in the end, it is between you and your God. It was never between you and them anyway. Take a moment to find your center and quiet yourselves as we enter this brief time of shared silence, a sacred time in which you can reflect on these words or just appreciate the fullness of life around you here. May you find both mindfulness and community in the quiet, deepening your connection to yourself and those around you, and opening you to experience the service in the present moment. Thank you. This reading is an excerpt from Paul Tillich's autobiographical essay, On the Boundary. I have written, the borderline is the truly propitious place for acquiring knowledge. When I received the invitation to give an account of how my ideas have grown from my life, it came to me that the concept of the borderline might be the fitting symbol for the whole of my personal and intellectual development. It has been my fate, in almost every direction, to stand between alternative possibilities of existence, to be completely at home in neither, to take no definitive stand against either. As fruitful as such a position is for thought, since thinking presupposes receptiveness to fresh possibilities, it is difficult and dangerous for life, which steadily demands decisions and thus exclusions from alternatives. From this disposition and these tensions have come both destiny and task.
I usually come to the service at 11:15, and so I find a lot of faces in here that I don't recognize, but it's nice to see you on this lovely, warm day. I want to thank Christina for sharing in the leadership of this service. And I want to thank Hal. Later in the service, he's going to sing a hymn by Ralph Vaughan Williams, who is my favorite contemporary English composer. And we've just sung one of his hymns a minute ago, which you don't know very well, and we should learn that better. It's one of the fine hymns. But I also want to thank you for putting up with Hal and giving him a home here over the years. And I have a deep appreciation for my own experience as a regular visitor, indeed for more than a decade now, in this UU Fellowship, in which I have been inspired, instructed, and challenged by the spiritual and intellectual gifts of your minister, and by the rich array of lay leadership with which you are blessed. I consider myself a visitor here after 19 years of retirement from the active pastorate. I continue to hold and to exercise my honorably retired status in the Presbyterian denomination. And I come in gratitude for the invitation to speak again in this pulpit. When Joe Coomerly and the committee invited me, they didn't know that this month is the 62nd anniversary of my ordination to the ministry. The ministry of what was, when I was ordained, the Southern Presbyterian Church. I was ordained in Alabama. And later, during my 40-odd years of active pastoral ministry, I served churches in 5 states and in 9 very diverse localities. So your invitation has become the occasion for my mind to range over the experiences of these years. Now, I'm not going to trouble you with everything that my mind has ranged over as I prepared for this. But it has been for me a very interesting and helpful time to think about those years. Pastoral experiences, of course, include preaching and teaching and administration and community work and other responsibilities. But in speaking of the pastoral act today, I'm thinking not of these things, but I'm thinking of the years of intimate personal association with scores of individual human beings in radically diverse situations. I'm thinking of the house calls that I've made and the hospital call. Back when it was all right to make house calls. Of course, since television and the internet come, you're not welcome to drop in like you used to be. Because you interrupt the program. But back when I started, this was mainly what I did. After breakfast in the morning and a time of meditation, I would go see people. House calls and hospital calls and nursing home calls, prison calls, funeral calls. This is what I consider to be the business of the pastoral act. Now, using the pastoral metaphor calls up the image of the shepherd looking after the sheep. Unfortunately, this invites comparison of people with dumb animals, which is not my intention in using this metaphor, although people can be pretty dumb. It is not that I want to focus on. I rather invite the image of the shepherd knowing his flock or her flock, each one personally, paying attention to each in accordance with his or her unique selfhood. Today I want to reflect on the essence of this pastoral act, which incidentally I don't intend to limit to professional clergy. I think the pastoral act is a part of all of our experiences. I begin with Luke's story of Jesus' visit with Zacchaeus, and I propose to use this brief narrative as a sort of a template against which to examine the pastoral act. This is the 19th chapter of Luke, beginning with the first verse. Entering Jericho, Jesus made his way through the city. There was a man there named Zacchaeus. He was superintendent of taxes and very rich. He was eager to see what Jesus looked like, but being a little man, he couldn't see him for the crowd. So he ran on ahead and climbed a sycamore tree in order to see him, for he was to pass that way. When Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said, "Zacchaeus, be quick and come down. I must come and stay with you today." He climbed down as fast as he could and welcomed him gladly. At this time, there was a general murmur of disapproval. Let me get my notes here, excuse me. There was a general murmur of disapproval among the crowd. "He's gone in," they said, "to be the guest of a sinner." But Zacchaeus stood there and said to the Lord, "Here and now, sir, I give half my possessions to charity. And if I've cheated anyone, I'm ready to repay him four times over." Jesus said to him, "Salvation has come to this house today, for this man too is a son of Abraham, and the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which is lost." Now that's the story of Jesus' visit to Zacchaeus. The simple elements of that story is that Zacchaeus is pictured as a man short in stature, evidently a Jew, known to be very rich, probably a collaborator with the Roman occupation force, indicated by his position as a tax superintendent. And so he was an object of popular resentment. We read that Jesus regarded Zacchaeus through the crowd and came over and spoke to him. "Zacchaeus, be quick and come down. I must come and stay with you today." And so Zacchaeus climbed down and welcomed Jesus into his home. Bystanders muttered their disapproval. "He has gone to stay with a sinner." Jesus was violating standards of purity and propriety. The act of Jesus sitting at table and breaking bread with a person who flaunted the canons of propriety and holiness was offensive to the people. The outcome of Jesus' visit was that Zacchaeus promised radical reparation. "I'll give half of all I have to the poor, and if I've cheated anyone, I'll give back four times as much." So Jesus affirmed Zacchaeus, "Salvation has come to this house today." This man whose life had been marked by relationships destructive of himself and of other people had been introduced to the possibility of healthy, life-affirming relationships. At the same time, Jesus rebuked the crowd. This man is a descendant of Abraham, just as you are. His rightful place as a member of the covenant people should not be forgotten. Now, how shall we approach the person of Zacchaeus and the attitude of the people toward him? The people's attitude must be seen against the background of the occupation of the land by the Roman Empire. As a tax collector and a likely collaborator with the occupation government, Zacchaeus was the object of the deep resentment which is typically directed toward occupation by foreign powers. News reports about the Middle East present us with bitter consequences of such resentments every day. And we would be mistaken if we thought of the land in which Jesus lived as a quiet, tranquil land. During the first century of the Christian era, there was an underlying turmoil against the Roman occupation, culminating in armed insurrection in the late 60s, provoking a powerful Roman reaction and the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple in 70 AD. But we would be mistaken if we would think that among the Jews there was a single unified response to the Roman occupation. Certain agreements between the Romans and the Levitical leaders made possible uninterrupted worship in the temple and a mutual acceptance between the Jews and the Romans. So there were those who accepted the Roman occupation in a friendly way. But there were also insurgent parties active among the Jewish people. There were zealots, various sorts of social banditry, and terrorism seeking to challenge the Roman occupation. A common way for the Romans to deal with other insurgents was by crucifixion. Historians tell us that in 4 BC, 2,000 Jewish insurgents were crucified under the governance of Publius Ventilius Verus. Now, though there's no indication that Jesus had any sympathy for armed rebellion against the Roman occupation or sympathy with the zealots and other insurgent groups, he was more identified with the peasantry than with Jewish authorities. But it is likely that Jesus' crucifixion was a consequence of his being falsely branded as an insurgent. Thus, popular antagonism toward a collaborator such as Zacchaeus would not have been surprising. So much for the attitude of the crowd. We're not told in the gospel why Zacchaeus sought to see Jesus in the first place. Perhaps simple curiosity, eagerness to see what Jesus looked like, or maybe some undefined need which caused him to cast about for something which would touch his feelings of isolation and emptiness and shame. We can only imagine what brought Zacchaeus to Jesus, what his experience was as a stranger among the people. The text speaks of him as being lost. Not only a stranger to his own people, but a stranger to himself. Whatever the cause, Zacchaeus' estrangement seems clear. And it was to this man that Jesus called out, "Come down. I must come and see you today. I must come and stay with you today." The account of Jesus' action in the visit is very spare. We can only imagine what was said in table conversation between them. We read only that Jesus regarded Zacchaeus, noticed him, singled him out, approached him. Nothing said of Jesus voicing any rebuke to Zacchaeus, nor of Jesus exposing the man's greed and his exploitations. Only that he regarded him and expressed his intention of coming to visit him and eat with him. On the surface, there's nothing remarkable about this, and yet when we consider the import of his gesture, we must recognize that within the scope of ordinary human action, the gesture of recognition was and is of inestimable power and significance. When others pay attention to us in a friendly way, we feel alive and vital. And when we feel accepted and affirmed, we feel fulfilled. For we human beings need acceptance, just as the birds need air and the fish need water. And when acceptance is lacking, the air becomes thin, our breathing falters, and we languish. Therefore, we are repulsed by the indifferent glance, we're hurt by disregard, and humanly destroyed when others deny us. In regarding Zacchaeus, Jesus ignored the prevailing pattern of expectations in human social relations, the ordinary boundaries of inclusion and exclusion. He ventured through the wall of estrangement and offered momentarily to participate in Zacchaeus' story. He sought to find who Zacchaeus really was. For Zacchaeus, this was to become an unbinding from his assumed past, an opening of windows for him to glimpse a different world than the world he'd come to know and take for granted, a glimpse of a way of being beyond the invisible and experienced possibilities of his life. So Jesus' visit with Zacchaeus seems to me to indicate and to illustrate what I would call the intention and the essence of the pastoral act, an act of paying attention to another and venturing to participate in that other's story. Venturing to enter into the narrative of the other's evolving identity, if you will. We don't have access to the personal narratives which were shared at the lunch table that day, but given the simple outlines of the story, we can imagine the nature of this pastoral visit, if you will. Now, what do I see as the primary elements of the pastoral act? First, the pastoral act requires paying attention. The recognition that persons are not abstract, isolated entities, but flesh and blood, living in particular times and places, and that these flesh and blood qualities change through time, each with his or her own history. Paying attention means listening and observing, setting aside preconceptions, and realizing the identifying qualities of another's personhood, showing respect, entering the narrative of the other's emerging identity. So we don't think that Jesus did all the talking at lunch that day. My wife has to remind me of that sometimes, but we think that there was some listening, some responsiveness to Zacchaeus' own story, if you will. Now, as we enter into the story of another person, we bring with us the narrative of our own evolving selfhood, which narrative assumes the root metaphors of our own nurturing community. As I converse with the other, I give glimpses of my own narrative. These narratives, the narrative of the visited and the narrative of the visitor, include discordant aspects as well as concordant aspects. And when they're brought together, new discordances or new concordances appear. They are disclosed. And what Tilly called boundary situations appear. Boundary situations, which, if I could just, in a parenthesis here, mentioning the theme of Tillich's autobiographical essay, which was an excerpt of which Christina has read here. Some of you will recognize the name of this great German Protestant theologian of the mid-20th century, who was the dominant influence in my seminary years, and who in the Hitler years came to the United States with the strong encouragement of the Unitarian thinker James Luther Adams, whom I've spoken about here before. As I have previously shared, Dr. Adams was one of my admired teachers in the Federated Theological Faculty of Chicago, which was itself an on-the-boundary institution, bringing together four theological faculties, three mainline Protestant faculties, and the Meadville Unitarian Seminary faculty. Truly a boundary situation when you bring together this breadth of tradition. And I can recall Dr. Adams' classes, how that he was a very strong and dedicated Unitarian, but he was so appreciative of Protestantism that he went to Europe and spent a time there studying Protestantism, and he got to know Paul Tillich, and he got Paul Tillich to come to this country, and he edited a remarkable book of his essays, which I would recommend to you, The Protestant Era. This was the character of that theological federation, to encourage people to hold their own views with conviction, but to listen to other people's views and to enter into dialogue with those who differ in position. This federation no longer exists, and I don't exactly know why it broke up. But Meadville is now Unitarian Universalist, and I imagine that Melissa and Renee and Karen, and I know Christy, have you been over there? At any rate, those of this fellowship here who have studied at Meadville would report probably a continuation of constructive interaction among the institutions which are still a part of that same neighborhood. Now, that was a parenthesis, and I don't want to go any longer on that because the clock is moving. But I think of my own pastoral years as having confronted me with boundary situations, as Tillich speaks of these, in many instances. Probably for me, preeminently racial boundaries. My growing up years were spent in segregated Alabama in an atmosphere which assumed the validity of Jim Crow. My mother and father assumed the validity of Jim Crow. This was followed by after I went to the seminary, I began to challenge those views. And then I went to my first pastorate in segregated Oktibbeha County, Mississippi, and spent a couple of years down there. To be a pastor to people who think Jim Crow is a challenge. Now, at the same time, I got to know some black people. There was in our county a school called the Moon Farm School. It had 120 children in it. The principal was a college graduate. He was a black man, he'd been to Holly Springs College up in Mississippi. The other teachers in the school the only education they had was that school. They graduated from that Moon Farm School, and they were the teachers there. And with a group of students from Mississippi State College, I got the opportunity to spend a lot of time out at the Moon Farm School and sense just what kind of life those people were living. then to grad school at the University of Chicago, during part of which time I was a member of a group ministry out on Chicago's west side. When masses of African Americans and Latinos were pouring into that city. And later a pastorate in a black slum just south of the university. A community noted for a strong Alinsky-led community organization and populated by a large and sometimes violent youth gang known as the Black Peystone Nation. I also think of my East Texas years in the late 50s when I organized and built a congregation in an oil refinery town among laborers in the oil industry there. Refineries, and we had at that time the struggles of members of my congregation in the formation of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union. I think of my feelings in Texas of being surrounded by Southern Baptist and Pentecostal fundamentalists, which really expressed the mentality of many of the people in my congregation. And yet for the duration of my Texas ministry, they were inseparable participants in my personal history and I in theirs. This is what I would call the challenge of being in the boundary situation. I could say more about that. I want to mention, for example, life in as a pastor in an urban slum there on Chicago's south side. And I think of the ongoing dealings and conversations with the leadership of the Black Peystone Nation and the challenge to enter into the personal histories of these young men, many of whom faced a future of violent death or imprisonment. People ask me, why did you approve of those people and let them into the church? The point is, they're people. And the question is, how do you ever hope to influence people until you get to know them and talk with them? These were boundary situations for my own pastoral ministry, and the clock is moving fast here, but I hasten to observe that boundaries take many shapes, and any pastoral act is likely to present the boundary situation challenge. And I would extend that notion of pastoral act to all, and when we enter into the life circumstances and stories of other persons, we face myriads of boundaries of belief and language, cultural, religious, and political. Last Sunday morning, we heard Melissa venture into the personal story of Joel Slater as they explored the boundary between meaning and truth. And we were reminded of the boundary, how boundaries occurred in our ways of speaking and thinking, and that we are pastorally challenged by the tension between the figurative language of symbolic, metaphorical speech on the one hand and positivistic conceptual speech on the other. I came away from last Sunday's service reminded that perhaps the most challenging boundary that we face is the boundary between different ways of speaking about the meaning of life. And we have to somehow associate with people and enter into the life history of people who speak about the meaning of life in different ways. The passage from Salome's Bread and Wine, which Christina has read, telling of the revolutionary in priestly disguise among peasants in the Italian hill town, puts flesh on these abstractions in a way which has long spoken to me. To establish relations between man and man, or I would say between person and person, two persons must be alone together, talk softly, and with many pauses, the better able to reflect. And I'd better pause before lunchtime comes, but I thank you again for the opportunity to be with you.
Today we are having our monthly special collection, which will go to the UUSC-UUA Joint Pakistan Relief Fund. That country is still desperately seeking assistance for relief, recovery, and reconstruction due to the severe flooding done last August. More information about this is in the thread from the web. Please consider giving as you are able. The offering will now gratefully be accepted.
Go forth into the world in peace, and go forth in the world in love and in faith, and may the power of the Spirit remain with you. Amen.